This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Hello. Testing, testing. Hey, guys. Come on. Bring it in.
Clap your hands now.
I'm Gregory Porter. Welcome to The Hang.
Watch what happens when the people catch wind of the water.
In each episode, I sit down and talk with a close friend of mine. With
spirit. It was around the time Norah Jones was coming out, Amy Winehouse. We were friends and we were doing tours together and stuff. But Wow. Someone going on like breakfast telly and talking about Herbie Hancock was not a thing.
Who's joining me this week?
Yeah, man. So we're in Cheltenham.
Obviously, we're here with the wonderful Jamie Cullum. This is The Hang.
You know, I certainly remember being the youngest person on the stage.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously, gradually that changes.
And now you're just the youngest looking person on stage. Let's do it. Come on.
You know, I never really did the whole car thing.
You seem like a fast car kind of guy.
You think so?
Yeah. You've been inviting me to your house and I've never been. I was going to check out your garage, but now I know.
Yeah.
You know, I ain't going to drive nothing. You know, it's going to be the same thing I got.
You know what's in my garage at the moment? A lot of like burst paddling pools. You know, like every year it bursts. And every year I think, oh, I'm gonna repair that. And then I go, oh, you know what? It's 20 quid on Amazon. I'm going to get another one. And then I think, oh, I can't throw it away because it's like bad for landfill. So I'm stuck with five of them.
Yeah, I got a bunch of swimming stuff in my garage. That's funny. All the stuff that my son is just like grown tired of, really. Yeah, you know, this alligator-shaped floaties, you know, for the pool. He's like, ah, I don't like the alligator anymore. Then he, you know.
So how old is your son now?
He's six.
He's six, because I think last time I saw your son, your wife was pushing him around in the rain in San Sebastian, and he was definitely not six. He was right. Still in at pram age.
Oh yeah.
And oh wow, yeah, it's racing by, huh?
For those Americans who don't know what a pram is, nobody else calls it a pram. I think it's a stroller, right?
Stroller, yeah. Mary Poppins calls it a pram.
Yeah,
pram, a stroller. Yeah,
but the prams here, you know, like if you got an old school one, it's got like, you know, like 4 8 spoke, you know, it's really kind of a sexy thing, you know, like white rubber tires and all this kind of thing.
Cadillac vibe.
Right. Yeah,
definitely. Right. No, we didn't use one of those. I swiftly moved on to one that you could fold up into as small a size as possible very quickly. We didn't have one with fancy wheels.
Okay.
It had no suspension.
Yeah.
It was very, very unposh. So we had basically like a piece of canvas strapped over some metal wheels. Yeah.
Jamie Cullum, obviously we've had some opportunity to make music and hang a little bit at different places in the world.
Yeah.
And so it's good to see you here.
You too, man.
We hung here before in Cheltenham. I've heard you call it Cheltenham a few times.
Well, I think it's the official way to call it, isn't it? No, I tell you what, you have got it right now. Cheltenham. You're saying it perfectly. I mean, you're basically the spirit of Cheltenham now, and it's a good thing. It's good for this town. They need someone like you to liven it up.
Yeah, I've been here a few times now. I really love it. You know, I like going, you know, maybe to the lesser known streets and lesser known shops too. It's you know, soulful.
It's got a nice vibe, and I think actually the festival has kind of grown in a way that I certainly didn't see coming.
Yeah.
And I think it's got a lot to do with the, you know, the people that run it, but also they just had great music here over the years.
Yeah.
And musicians enjoy coming here because it's like, it's out of London.
Right.
Most people stay over. Most people stay up late.
Yeah.
Most people get into some trouble.
Right.
And it's a good hang. And if you create an environment where musicians like to hang out, you're onto a winner, I reckon.
The Hang.
Yeah.
The Hang. Right. The late night jams that happen here in the Hotel Devin. Hotel Duvin.
Yeah.
I have been very, very cool. I remember I had done my show. I stayed and had a drink at the bar, and then I went up to my room And then I said, oh, I'll just go back down just for a little bit. And I ended up staying until they start putting the bread out for breakfast.
Yeah, that's an official Cheltenham Jazz Festival thing. But I've got a question for you. Now that you are like working at the rate that you are, yeah, and your career has gone in exactly the way it should have done, do you still do that? Or do you go, do you know what? I'm a busy man. I've got to get some sleep.
No, I do. Like, there's jam sessions all over the world, and I don't do a lot of them. Or there'll be a late night thing happening. But generally, I have a 5, you know, a.m. flight to the next venue. So, you know, my hang is strategic, you know. You know?
Yeah.
So I can't do it back to back to back. I have, and plus, the voice has to be...
Talking is the enemy.
Right. Yeah. Talking, and generally, you'll be talking with some loud music.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful with the instrument. So there's a balance because music is social, and I think you should be social with other musicians. But you have to be careful about taking care of your instrument, especially when you have.
Well, totally. But you definitely don't want to do anything stupid like starting a podcast, for example.
Right.
Yeah. Don't do that.
Right, starting a podcast and talking to people for an hour before their show. That's the way we do it.
That's all good for me, man. It's all good for me.
You know, Jamie, being in your upper 30s and, you know, knowing that you've been in the broadcast business for...
The grandfather
for 30
of the broadcasting industry.
For 30-some-odd years.
Yeah. What do you want to know, man? Come on.
You have any tips for me for my...
Well, I'm going to need a little time to process. I'll make some notes. I'll say, do you know what? I think I got some kind of advice from various people, actually, people that I love. So I don't know whether you know who this guy is, a guy called John Peel. He's sadly deceased, but I grew up listening to him on the radio as the kind of godfather of music radio. Like, he really started so many people's careers just by his love of music.
Yeah.
And he made so many mistakes, right? If you think about mistakes, particularly on live radio, he'd start the wrong song. He'd play whole songs at the wrong speed. He'd stumble over words. He'd get names wrong. But he is one of the greatest broadcasters of all time. Terry Wogan, another one.
Right? I got it. Beautiful man.
You know, these guys would make mistakes, but they... were conversationalists and things. You're a natural conversationalist, so that I think the battle is half there. And I always think, if you feel like you're talking to one, you don't think of your audience as like the millions of people out there.
Yeah,
you just feel like you're talking to that one person who's sitting there.
Yeah,
they're on the train, they've got their headphones on, they go, hey, let's listen to the Gregory Porter podcast. He's talking to me.
Yeah,
that's it. And you're already doing that. But that's the advice I always tell myself. It's like, don't go, hey, everybody out there. It's like, hey, you out there, you know? And your thing is, your music's like that. It always feels like you're talking to me when
exactly,
I hear this thing.
Exactly.
So, that's the only thing I think I would ever give anyone the advice to, because actually, if you overthink it, you're going to balls it up already.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Yeah. You're a legend. This is, I mean, it's your natural home, man.
All right. You know, it's funny. I was reading the notes, and it said that you are not 40 yet. Is that correct?
I'm going to be 40 this year. Yeah, August the 20th is my.
Okay, let me just tell you how insane that is, because I kind of feel like you're like my older brother, my grandfather in a way. I remember with your first record, your first splash into the environment of music. I remember looking at your career and your energy and saying, you know, that's something I would like to have. And so it's so interesting. We see each other at festivals, and so now I'm looking down at the paper at 39. What the heck?
All that, you know,
you've been around forever. You've been around for 30 years and you're 39. Explain that. Player.
Maybe I have this way of making time go slow. When I first had a big success with this album, 20 something, I was 23, really, 23, 24, 22, between 22 and 24 was when that album came out. So that's, you know, it's now a long time ago. But at the time, in terms of like someone who was using jazz in a commercial pop world, it wasn't really a major, you know, this is pre-Michael Bublé.
Right.
It was around the time Norah Jones was kind of coming out. There was a Amy Winehouse was we were friends and we were doing tours together and stuff. But
wow.
It was someone going on like breakfast telly or mainstream telly and talking about Herbie Hancock was actually not a thing.
Right. Shocking.
Well, it kind of especially like some like, you know, white kid from the west of England, you know what I mean? Who like really kind of grew up more around hip hop and drum and bass and all these kind of things and like the rock bands I'd been in and stuff. So I think I was unnaturally in people's faces, particularly in jazz people's faces. And it caused quite a lot of, I got quite a lot of stick at the beginning because I was not a trained jazz musician. Actually my jazz chops as such have always been, carved out in quite a renegade way and not in a way that, so I knew lots of jazz musicians who'd done the whole college thing.
Yeah.
They knew their modes and their chord scale relationships. They had transcribed 1,000 solos. You know, here comes me, right?
Right.
I don't even know what the names of chords are.
Right.
I know how to play 150 standards from playing, you know, loads of gigs, but actually it had this impact in a way on the commercial scene, but also within the jazz scene. And we're like, well, why is that guy doing it? And I think it had a lot to do with the energy I kind of threw at it, which was just the energy of like loving music.
Yeah.
You know, I was young. I kind of attacked it with a kind of pop musician's mentality.
Yeah.
But with the I always had a love, like a true love of jazz. You know, like I had posters of Wynton on my wall.
Right.
You know, I had like a poster of Sonny Clark on my wall.
Right.
You know, I'd also grown up loving a mixture of, you know, Modesky, Martin and Wood, but also Harry Connick Jr. And Q-Tip and the, you know, Tribe Called Quest and all this kind of stuff. So it was all this stuff kind of thrown at it. And it must have been, you must have been one of those jazz guys who gone, well, why is that guy doing it?
No, actually, I was very cool with it because I like the way you. Well, first of all, the energy and the youthfulness that you brought to it. I didn't have a career when you. I was still trying to figure out how to make it happen. So to see you doing it was like, yeah.
But were you doing gigs around that time?
I was doing gigs. Yeah, yes, yeah. I was doing gigs, but in terms of anybody knowing me. No.
Well, you must have always had that voice, though. Your voice is there.
But nobody cares.
Nobody
cares about a voice until they care about the voice, you know.
Sure.
Because, you know, I was just thinking, I had a pretty great voice when I was, you know, doing $30 gigs.
Mm.
And it was still a $30 gig, you know what I mean? And I'm not mad about it because those $30 gigs have seasoned my voice and seasoned my approach and my understanding of what music does to people. So, you know, I'm glad that I'm here now, but...
Because I really relate to that because, obviously, you know, by the time I was doing the bigger... you know, the telly shows and the things that are high stakes.
Yeah.
I felt like, you know, I was wearing crappy clothes and I had a terrible haircut. I had no kind of like, I hadn't really kind of worked on kind of look or anything or any of that stuff that you're supposed to do.
Right.
But I had done thousands of gigs in crappy places for $30, you know? And so I'm like, well, you know, I know I don't sing like Aretha Franklin and I don't play like Bill Evans, but I know I can get an audience to be on my side, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, and I think in coming to the music, however you come to the music in an organic way, that realness, that authenticity comes out. You know, just like in music, I'm always talking about this organic thing. And I think that's what you're talking about in an approach to radio or broadcasting or podcasts is maybe sometimes leaving the cracks or the pops and the pimples in the music, in the conversation. I mean,
yes, yeah.
I just made a crack and a pop and a pimple just then. But
people love that, and I think also in music, sometimes, you know, the level of musicianship that you can end up working with, it's like they're making mistakes in like inverted commas, but actually it sounds too smooth.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, like a mistake is Tommy Flanagan's piano solo on Giant Steps where he didn't quite know the changes.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But actually we all know Tommy Flanagan's like an unbelievable piano player.
Right,
but like,
right.
John Coltrane turns up with the changes for Giant Steps. Right. And it's like, whoa, okay. And actually, you know, should they have got, given him another run at it?
Mm.
I don't know.
No, I it's love like, that floaty thing that yeah. happened. He's like, he's just floating after yeah. that. And I was like, it makes me, yeah.
It takes the ego, because it's like, he, you know, he sounds like he can't yet play it.
Right.
And actually, I think there is a lot to learn about ego from that, and a lot to learn about that. And I think radio, podcasts, you know, often when I go to jazz concerts, I think it's too good. You know, I need a little more risk. And, you know, I certainly feel that when I go to see a big pop concert, and it's sort of like a stage show, you know, you want a little bit more of the, you know, actually, I think Michael Bublé is a good example of someone who just keeps a little bit of like spit and sawdust in there. And that may be all made up. I don't know, but I just get the impression he's the guy who spent a lot of time, you know, at those clubs. You know, I went to see him when he did Ronnie Scott's, and he wasn't yet a big star.
Yeah.
And we chatted, and he's like, he did all that stuff, and
yeah.
he knows how to bring a little bit of that to the stadium, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I think when you're doing stadiums, when you're doing the arenas, like, I think you're going to be that guy who's able to just keep a little bit of the shit on the shoe,
right.
you know, that keeps it interesting, because yeah. I think people love that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's a thing that you do that I'm about to steal.
Great.
You did these.
I'm so pleased about that.
You did these concerts in these very small venues.
Yeah.
And just the way it looked to the eye and on film was gorgeous. I like that idea of doing that in different
with
places.
These like concert films or
yeah, you did. Yeah. I don't know what it was. I don't know. I don't even know where I saw it.
Yeah,
but it was you and just these, you know, tight environments.
Yeah,
and
it's you know what I feel like when you have to make your music happen in those environments. Maybe you've got like just a bass drum and a snare drum.
Yeah,
just the upright bass. Maybe it's not a real piano. I don't know. Maybe it's like a electric keyboard or just an accordion. I don't know. Those situations. I nick all that stuff from Jack White, the White Stripes, man. I love the way he talks about, you know, really limiting his options.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this time I'm just going to do this with these instruments.
Yeah.
You know, talk about stealing things. This book is like my Bible. It's called Steal Like an Artist. Do you know it?
I don't know.
It's by a guy called Austin Kleon. He's a writer and a cartoonist and just like a professional, curious person.
Mm-hmm.
And he is amazing. He has this book. He says, you take every artist steals from somewhere, whether it's David Bowie, whether it's, you know, and either great artists, you think, oh, they just plucked out of thin air. They didn't pluck it out of thin air, you know.
Yeah.
It's all there to steal okay. and make your own,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I Jack White is one of those people I look up to so much. His whole aesthetic of like taking things and limiting himself and see what happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where I got that idea from.
You know, it's funny. This is how my music career started. I grew up singing in churches, storefront churches, small churches that had a piano or didn't have a piano or had a piano with compromised tuning or missing keys or, you know. So at the point at which I made it to where there's always a Steinway on the stage, you know, my piano player, Chip Crawford, can throw me a chord and it doesn't rattle me because... Mm. I've heard a lot of different things come out of a piano.
Yeah, definitely.
you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes the limitation, and this is a thing in African American music. People talk about the melisma of black music. That sound comes from the ear wanting to hear all the notes, but not having an instrument present when you're in the fields. And so I don't dismiss, you know, somebody who oversings sometimes because it's a process. Sometimes when you first start singing off, you first start singing, you want to sing a million notes, but there's a tradition of that and it comes from somewhere. And so I don't dismiss it all the time. Sometimes, you know, I don't like to hear it all the time, but
sure.
but um, But I know that it's a it comes from somewhere, and generally a more mature singer makes more subtle choices. But anyway, that was just a little side note. Sometimes limitation can bring about change, even in the style of singing. And in the past and even today, I was considering your voice, the type of voice that it is, and it's you have a unique sound. You talked about the imagery and maybe the background of you that may have made you popular initially, but it's your voice, your instrument. It's unique. For me, it's I don't want to say understated, but it's you loosen the collar of the tuxedo, you know, because your voice is in between. And hear me when I say this. The raspy quality of it in the lower parts is early morning. And in the higher part of your voice, it's 9:30 in the evening. Very sophisticated. And the two together is disarming and dope. And so it's your instrument as well.
I love that description. And you know, thank you. I consider you really like one of the great voices of our generation.
Oh man!
And so I listen to the voice that you have and the instrument you have and aspire. You know, it's one of the voices I aspire to. First time I heard it, first I aspired to making sure people got to hear it that I could, and then you know, it was like, wow, what can I learn from this? And I think, again, I very much did everything on the fly with my voice. You know, I'm always like backing up and going, okay, what am I actually doing here? Uh-huh. And I've thought a lot more about my voice in the last 5 or 6 years. And just, I still feel like I have a lot of energy, but I have to channel my energy in different places as well as just to the voice. So I do look after it in a different way. And I do kind of practice. But actually, really, the thing I feel like I focused on more than anything in the last few years is songwriting. That's the thing I like. Yeah. I think about when I wake up and I think about when I go to sleep. It's like, okay, how am I going to finish this song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm. In your career, how many records now?
Do you know what? The one that's coming out in June is going to be my 8th record.
Yeah.
And you've done that in the last 2 years, though.
No, I'm not making records like you.
I know how they work you at Decca. Yeah, it's like, we need another record.
I'm always doing just different little side projects. But you have in your writing and in your projects, you've been very, you know, varied. Your writing and your just the different things that you're doing, and the sound of the record has always been changing. So that's another.
But, you know, I always think of myself as I come at it as a fan, right? So before I was a musician, really, I was a trainee Giles Peterson. You know, I was the guy going to record fairs, like going, oh man, this one's produced by the Mizell brothers. And, right. You know, this one's got a Fender Rhodes on it. This is going to be great. Oh my God, acoustic. Ron Carter, let's pick this one up.
You right.
Know? I was that guy, right?
Right.
And I kind of got into the playing through being a fan.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the reasons jazz was such a pull for me was because I kind of felt like if you kind of immersed yourself in jazz, you could reach out beyond, and you could reach out as a songwriter. You know, from the songwriting point of view, you've got, like, you know, from Joni Mitchell to Cole Porter to Irving Berlin.
Yeah.
You know, from the musicianship side, you've got from Professor Longhair to Herbie to Art Tatum to, God, I don't know, Steve Winwood,
yeah.
Traffic, all right. That kind of stuff. And then, you know, lyrically, you can draw from, you know, this huge pool, whether it's the poetry of Allen Ginsberg or the I don't know, the words of Rodgers and Hart, all that kind of stuff.
You got me thinking of Eddie Jefferson to Abby Lincoln.
Yeah.
It's huge. The umbrella is huge.
Yeah.
And if you're for me, when people say, when you hear somebody utter the words jazz is not for me, it's like, it's because you haven't heard what is for you. Mm-hmm. Because there's something for everybody, really. I mean, if a great DJ could prescribe the perfect song for the person who thinks that they don't love jazz. I mean, because everything is out there.
Well, you know, that's what Giles Peterson has been doing for, you know, I look at him as someone who has inspired me almost as much as any musician has.
Wow.
Because I grew up listening to his tapes of his radio shows that someone recorded me when he was on a pirate radio station in London. Like, I'm talking like I was a teenager,
so dope,
you know?
Man.
And he
That's
was playing dope. Club records, super underground, like Mark Murphy stuff from the 70s,
yeah,
dance jazz. And I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
And again, you know,
he always just knows more than you and just, you know, has listened more than you. It's just, he's a clever dude, man.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, I realize this as I get older, and it's quite freeing. It's like, I think there was a time in my late 20s where I felt like, oh my God, I'm not good enough. I'm here in my career, but man, I'm not good enough. And actually, the thing is, you're never going to be good enough. You know, I read a great biography of Bill Evans. He was always building blocks of his work. He was always just building slowly, you know. I mean, he was pretty much always doing heroin as well. That's one thing. But he was always building his music, and there's always going to be someone who sings better. There's always going to be someone who writes better songs. There's always going to be someone, but there's only you, first of all, who can communicate your truth. And I was thinking that about record collecting, you know. You think you've got the most records. You think you know the most about Blue Note records, you know. You know, yeah. Giles knows more about Blue Note records than Don Was does.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? And he runs the label.
Right.
And, you know, it's there's always someone who can run faster.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Hey, guys. You're listening to The Hang. Hit subscribe or follow on your podcast thingamajig of choice to get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I feel like, quite frankly, you and I are the modern jazz vocalists is in a interesting but sweet time, because we have all of this great history that came before us, and we have the opportunity to mix that history with our own identity. We have to write. You're a writer. I'm a writer. We make our own story, make our own legacy, but we also hold on to what came before.
Mm.
And with jazz, there's a tradition of that. And so it's not frowned upon. You know, I was listening to hip-hop radio the last couple of days. I was driving in my car in California, and a lot of, in the lyrical content, they kept saying, you know, about talking about old rappers, you had your chance, move on, move out of the way, to the old hip-hop stars, icons.
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting. I mean, I really, really heard it a lot enough to really notice it. And I if we listen to hip hop interviews, a lot of the old masters, geniuses of the music, talk about that.
Mm.
But in jazz, it's something that has to happen. I mean, if you're a great piano player and a great singer, you cut your teeth and have been inspired by somebody who came before you. And you also reference them in the new work that you're doing.
Mm.
And it's kind of keeps this fabric of the music going in a steady way. I don't think jazz will ever die, if you ask me, because there's a continuum.
Yeah.
Yes.
That feels more apparent than ever, I think, now, having a benefit of a bit of hindsight, you know, particularly doing my radio show, and you meet, I'm meeting all these musicians who say, oh my God, I saw you on the television when I was 11, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, and it's of course, it's like, yeah, of course that happens when you're about to be 40, you know, and Jacob Collier, he says, I saw your first prom, you know, I'm like, wow. You could probably sightseeing before you came out of the
right.
the womb, to be honest, but
right.
it is funny to think that, but you know, I certainly remember being, you know, the youngest person on the stage.
Yeah.
And then you obviously gradually that changes.
And now you're just the youngest looking person on stage.
Do you know what? Looking 12 your whole life has its disadvantages, I promise you.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Suddenly I'm going to look 80. You know? I'm the Michael J. Fox of jazz pop crossover, you know? They'll be on my tombstone.
I have a story about Michael J. Fox. I'll tell it later.
Oh, just excellent.
Don't let me forget about it.
Cool.
It actually breaks my heart. But.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, you're going to keep me hanging on that one.
Well, yeah. No, I'll tell it now, and then we'll get back to our discussion of music. I was invited to this Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon. He has this essentially a few days, a weekend, longer than a weekend. It's like 4 or 5 days, and you're sequestered in this hotel. It's called Campfire. I don't know if I'm even allowed to talk about it, but I am.
Excellent.
And there's like people who are like either at the top of something or quite popular in something at the moment are invited. And so there'll be all of these, you know, Bette Midler and, you know, Harry Kissinger, you know, this, you know, cool. Heavyweights.
Yeah.
I said Harry, didn't I?
Yeah.
You know, but heavyweights, and there's hundreds of them. Iconic people from around the world. Anyway, somehow I got the invite, and Michael J. Fox was there, and you know he's having some difficulty with his
Parkinson's.
Parkinson's. Yeah. So I'm going into the bathroom just before my performance.
Got to happen. Right. You got to do that. You know, nothing worse than a full bladder right. before you're about to sing 1960 Watt. Do you know what I mean? It's like things can go really wrong.
Very wrong, right?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the band that I was playing with was Lenny Kravitz on drums, Dave Matthews on guitar, Nona Hendricks is the background singer. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
Right.
And they all needed the bathroom too?
Right, yeah. Right. And Who was on? It was somebody ridiculous. Oh, John Bon Jovi is on bass.
Dude, I was totally available.
Yeah.
I just want you to know, I was totally available.
Yeah, so this was a crazy band that I was working with. Anyway, so I'm trying to make myself a bit more comfortable, and I go into the accessible toilet.
Yeah.
And
I think I know what's coming.
The one time that I did it. And I never do that. I always, you know, leave it for people.
Yeah, bad form, man.
It's bad form. Yeah. I went into
but
it.
But needs must.
Right.
Yeah.
But the very one time that I do that, Michael J. Fox, as I'm coming out, I see him, you know, struggling to get inside of the regular toilet. And I felt like a terrible
person.
Like an idiot, because he gave me this look like, man, really? Come on, man, really? You know what I'm saying? You know, because there was like 8 toilets, but they were all, you know, occupied. And so I should have just waited and done the right thing. But God, Greg, man, I just broke my heart.
That's the one time. And
that's
you were caught
the one
out
time,
by my
one...
Michael J. Fox.
Right, oh, right. Man. And he gives me a look like, dude, really? Really? And I had no sympathy for myself, but I was hoping that he would stay so he would know that I'm a cool guy. Because
exactly.
I mean, I think they asked me to do 3 songs. The first song I went to do was "Take Me to the Alley," and in my mind I was like, okay, that'll let him know that I'm a cool guy. And then
that whole song you were just looking out for Michael J. Fox. Where is he?
Right,
where
right. Is he? And the next one will be "When Love Was King," you know.
Yeah.
And so he's like, okay, he's not a jerk, you know, but. But I've always used music as a way to express who I am as a man and as a person, the things that I want to say to the world or to just a room of people. Do you find that your music has been representative of who you are?
Well, that's a really timely question for me, actually. And, you know, firstly, I'll say I think one of the really interesting things about you having your moment and taking it and, you know, becoming the musical star that you have is that actually I feel like you knew who you were as a man when you had your moment, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you were ready to take that stage, you could say, this is who I am, this is my music, and look, I know we all develop, but actually, you were a grown man by the time. You know, a lot of people become adults in the face of that. And I think that's one of the many reasons why, you know, the stars aligned. You know, for me, you know, I've been discovering that along the way. And, you know, my mistakes have been made. You know, look, I'm not Justin Bieber, but, you know, to some degree, I've been working that stuff out on a more public situation within my music. And actually, this record, it started 5 years ago. And, you know, I have two young kids, and you know what that's like. But I started this record and I made some really good tracks, right? I was like, yeah, this is coming together, and had like 5, 6, 7 songs. I'm like, yeah, you know, I had things that sounded like singles and this one will work great on radio and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I just had this moment about a year into that. It just all felt wrong. And I'll tell you why. It's because the music was great. Songs were solid, but they were not matching up with the man I was becoming.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't expressing who I was becoming. And that sounds pretty grand. It doesn't need to be grand. It's just, it didn't sound truthful. You know, I likened it in my own head to like when an aging pop star is still writing songs about going to the club and doesn't go to the club anymore and actually is just like wants to be in bed by like 9:30. And again, it's not that that was me, and I didn't want to write songs about taking my kids to school, but the reality of my life was I was touring like 80% less than I used to, right?
Yeah.
So I was on the road really like 25 dates a year.
Yeah.
I was taking my kids to school every day,
right,
bringing them home. I was reading a hell of a lot about all sorts of things, philosophy, space, physics, science.
Dope.
I was learning a lot about my family history, which is, you know, I have refugees on both sides.
Dope.
I am in a marriage with a very emotionally intelligent woman. And I had a lot of housekeeping to do, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of housekeeping to do as a person. And, you know, my initial thought was that, okay, well, I'll do all that and then I can put it into my music. It's going to be great. That didn't work either. So I realized I had to do this stuff, just I had to take a step back and actually just become, you know?
Yeah.
And so I actually spent quite a bit of time not really just going to the studio every day, just like being a person. And again, my life isn't so grand at all. I'm not saying that like people were begging me for an album. It's like the public, like, when's Jamie's album? There's nothing, nothing like that. I think when you get in that kind of, you get on that hamster wheel of it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you forget that actually you're accountable, you know, to yourself, you're accountable to your kids, you're accountable to your wife, accountable to your friends, your family. So it took a little time.
Yeah.
And after a while, I started to write songs with, I think, some real, some real authenticity to them. And I'm not saying I haven't done that in the past, but this record that I've just made is called Taller. It feels like it's got some emotional weight to it that has not come before. And so I threw all that stuff away. I threw all those songs away.
Wow.
And started from scratch.
Okay.
And I started at home on my own. I wrote 10 songs.
Yeah.
And I recorded 10 songs. I made it with my buddy Troy Miller, who I know really well. Quite a few of these songs, I setting up the mics, pressed record myself, chose the best take, and then me and Troy would work on them. You know, there's a few tunes I'm playing bass on myself, a few tunes, you know, I'm kind of layering up the Hammond and a few different things. And I don't know whether it's what the people want to hear. I don't know whether it's what radio want to hear, but I feel like I can stand behind this. And it feels really exciting in a way that things haven't felt exciting before.
That's wonderful, man. Mm. That's the... You know, in this time of your life, even what you were talking about, that you a moment to live. It's the part of life that I never considered after college. You know, when you going to college or whatever study history that you may have, it even may have ended in high school for some people. Education never stops. So now, when I have a moment to like read about psychology or Greek mythology or just African American history or just my own American history, the unedited versions, I feel like I'm becoming a better person for the music.
Yeah. curiosity is it's the fountain of youth, really. You know, yeah. I mean, I think it's the thing I really got from my parents and their grandparents. My mum was born in Burma. She came over when she was 4 or 5 in the middle of the night. My dad was born in Jerusalem. His mother escaped Nazi Germany, and you know, so they all ended up in the UK as you know, refugees.
Yeah,
and with very compromised upbringings and lives, but their curiosity, they needed to fit in. You know, yeah. I think that was something that was a real feature of their lives. They needed to, like, okay, look, you're in this country, you need to fit in, keep your head down and get on with it. So I got a work ethic from them, but curiosity, you know, my dear grandmother, who, you know, she lost her family, was not ever reunited with her wider family when she escaped in Prussia during the World War II. But her flat was like, I just remember it as it felt like one of those rooms in Harry Potter that's just like, there's books, like, you can't really see any walls, you know, it's just books everywhere. And, you know, I'd come back from my A-level English course and I think, oh man, I'm reading some really deep stuff. You know, no one's going to know this. And like I say, oh, Toni Morrison. Yeah, yeah, I've read all her stuff. And she's like, not only she read all of Toni Morrison's books, but like she's got notes in the margins. You know, she's not studying. She's writing notes in the margins about the imagery and the poetry. And I'm like, that was, you know, that was on one side, you know, it's like, it's there. And I think that curiosity is, you know, part of what my album is about, is this, how there's all these things that make us feel disconnected, but actually I'm trying to take these things that make us feel disconnected and use it to satisfy my curiosity, you know. Yeah. I try to make my phone, for example, like a temple of like interest, but for the things that really interest me, yeah. Not just pretty pictures, but like, you know, obviously look, podcasts, yeah. You know, books, audiobooks, yeah. You know, websites that I feel really enrich me. I'm just trying to soak all that stuff up. Yeah. And I feel the same way about you, about curiosity, you know, keep it fresh,
that's really cool. Cause it can find its way to the music and fortify the music.
Where's your writing at the moment? What are you, I know.
Well, yeah, I'll be recording soon.
Of course you are. You've always got something going, man.
Well, so I'm trying to just, you know, kind of raise my hands up and my eyes up to the sky and let it radiate into me and then, you know, and see what comes out organically. Again, you know, it's the stories of love, trying to find the angle of the message and the melody. And, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you'll get the message and the story, but the melody and you know, and they don't match. Hmm. So you know how writing a song is just, it's some magic. I'm trying to simplify. I'm trying to be as, the brevity of the blues is genius.
Yeah.
The brevity of the blues is genius. And I think to give a message, there's a technique in Black American preaching. You're constantly coming back to a particular line to remind the congregation, just to stick that line again, over and over and over again. And the blues does that. And so I want to continue to write music that way, where when you're done listening to a song of mine, I don't want to overwhelm you with the cleverness of my poetry. I want to overwhelm you with the sincerity of my message. Mm. And that's what I'm trying to find. Yeah. You know, you keep sifting through the sand until you find the gold. That's where I am. Some things are cool and some things are like, you know, not that cool.
You have any little demos yet or anything?
I have some demos. You know what I have also have been doing recently is listening to something that I've done in the past. Sometimes that reinforces what I'm trying to say currently. It's not retelling the story, it's the continuation of the story of optimism, of love, or mutual respect, or, you know, justice. So I'm still exploring the same themes, but...
Well, they're even more pertinent than ever, though, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah. I think... as I travel, and, you know, we travel around the world, you know, I can't help but be affected by people and politics that I see around me. And I And I have to be careful not to let it overwhelm my music because it's heavy on my heart. I have to remember to talk about the other things that are going on in life, in the spectrum of music. But you could let it overwhelm me. You really can. It's some frightening things that are happening out there. But that's interesting. Even just to hear you talk about the fabric of your family and where they come from and their struggles already, just even in the conversation, the authenticity has bumped up and jumped up. Not just the fact that I wondered where you get your wonderful tan from. It's not
Yeah, I know people think I've been on the sunbeds. Yeah. Yeah.
Not just that, but just the you know, just to hear you talk about your parents and your grandmother, that I've already fallen in love with them. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
So if you put some of their energy into the music, you know, my mother has you know, engraced me to millions of people. They loved me, but, you know, my mother seasoned it. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
So, you know, I, without even hearing the music yet, Jamie, I'm already intrigued. So yeah, that'll be dope. I'm looking forward to it.
Cool, man.
Yeah, man. So we're in hanging in Cheltenham.
Cheltenham.
We're in Cheltenham.
So you hear
in the Cotswolds.
You hear all, yeah, we're in, this is like deep Cotswolds, man.
Yeah.
This is literally speak a different language.
I mean, woo. Lashings of cream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. You got it. I think you fit right in, man. I think this is it. It's your spiritual home. Are you here all weekend?
I am, yeah.
You are.
Yeah. What's the title? You know, if you do, you know, if you are artist in residence or curator or there's a festival, the Nice Jazz Festival, they kept calling me the grandfather. I'm like, what? I'm the grandfather of the festival. I was like, wait a minute, I'm not ready to be a grandfather, y'all.
did they mean godfather or did they mean grandfather? Because godfather makes more sense.
Right.
There might have been a translation mistake there.
Right.
So how do you like doing this? I mean, are you a podcast listener, as it were?
Yeah. I like, you know, I've always liked extended, like NPR. I like it extended or BBC.
Conversation is better than interviews.
Extended conversations or interviews are always better because you get a deeper understanding. You know, because we're running, this may be one of the longest conversations that we've had. I have an affection for you and you have for me, but... Yeah, because we're moving all the time.
Yeah.
So it was really great to sit down with you and talk about the new project, Taller. Right.
Yeah, Taller. Yeah, that's coming out in June, and you know, it's I think that this is like, I love hearing your voice singing. I love hearing your voice talking. So I think this is great. It's such a great plan, and it's just it's awesome that as many people get to hear your music as they do, because it's like it just made me feel like things sometimes in the universe are correct.
Yeah. Well, you were either the first or one of the first to play me in the UK, and the genesis of my career was emanating from here. So I would say, yeah.
Well,
between you know, if
I'll take that, and I'll if whether that was true or not, I remember shouting about you saying, this guy's amazing.
Right. Well, so somebody called me and said, Jamie Cullum is like playing one of your songs, you know, like every time he's on the radio. And I was like, oh, okay, that's dope. I appreciate that. Well, thank you.
Hey, my pleasure, man. And look, thanks for...
I'll get that check to you soon.
No, I'll tell you what, let's come over to my house, we'll do lunch.
Okay.
And cool. We'll have part two of the conversation.
Okay.
And we can get in the paddling pool.
Okay.
Get in the paddling pool, the non-punctured one. We can hang out in a different part of the English countryside. It's a little different to here.
Okay.
But I think you'll like it.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Cool, looking forward to it, man.
Wicked.
Thank you.
Great to see you, Gregory.
My pleasure.
Cool, man.
Thank you. So there it is. Don't forget, you can listen to The Hang on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher,
or the podcast thingamajig of your choice and get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses.
Clap your hands now.
This is Gregory Porter. Thank you so much for joining me. You've been listening to The Hang, a Cup and Nuzzle production. Come on, bring it in.